for another DraftPhysics.com, DebatePhysics.com also, video presentation. So kind of an overview style video, kind of attacking or debunking or refuting or counter-arguing what standard science says, the conventional belief about what physics is and what it is to talk about reality, physical reality. So I've said many times that there's only one universe, and it's the small universe. And what the small universe is doing is basically transferring motion between something we call forces, little tiny stuff with momentum, the stuff that light would be made out of and gravity would be made out of and magnetism would be made out of, little elemental stuff, and material stuff like electrons and protons, and then the atoms that the electrons and protons are often stuck in. And that's all that really is going on. There's a thermodynamics that happens in the universe between the force moving the speed of light and the matter that moves less than the speed of light. And that's really like the big idea. You don't get that one right, sort of everything else won't fall into place. But if you sort of understand that that's really what's happening, little things are hitting big things, and big things are reducing heat, you know, through the mechanisms of interaction, friction, back into little things again. Little things going in all kinds of directions often. So the universe takes order, that is some big thing moving in one direction, and turns it into a kind of disorder by turning it back into little things moving in lots of directions, and the inverse. And so there's just really another two ideas. There's either the consumption of energy and then the storage of energy. And you can sort of understand that if you can store it, that is, you can trap this stuff moving the speed of light, then you can release it at any time in any direction and create action wherever you point that gun, so to speak. And that would be represented in things like photons and radiation and you know, the idea of magnets and other things that seem directional and ordered. But they're really just pattern. Then they're really just what's already in the universe, which is a lot of energy. And it's just really saying, I've collected it in one place, and you know, there's an abundance in one place and an absence of it in another place. You've clumped it, you've bunched it up. And the same thing can be done to the matter. You can bunch it up, and it'll behave differently from your ability to observe it than otherwise. All right, so physics is just thermodynamics, would be the argument, substantially. You're just really trying to isolate the interactions between the little stuff moving the speed of light and the bigger stuff. And then everything else, gravity and light and charge and magnetism, are just manifestations, you know, ways that you can have those interactions. And then there's the other part of physics that talks about relativity and, you know, some sort of notion that what's really happening isn't really happening. Like there's a Heisenberg or an entanglement or all this other stuff. And all that stuff is unevidenced and made up. And it isn't really physical. And it really doesn't have anything to do with the simplicity of the interaction between just momentums, little things with momentum and big things with momentum. So I'll try to get into all of that. So I guess the first place to go is gravity. So that's the one that's right in front of us all the time. You know, we are constantly manipulating our center of gravity. All of our motions, all of our actions are all dictated by this idea that you have to balance that force. You have to take advantage of its existence. You have to accept its existence. And what I would argue is so conventional science says that gravity isn't a force, that it's some sort of thing where just the matter somehow knows to be manipulated by the gravity. And they argue that things like photons, light photons anyway, are somehow also manipulated by this field of energy, this, they won't even call it that. So this idea that there's some configuration of space itself that somehow obliges electrons and protons to move. And again, that also causes whatever you think a photon is to be bent, to be pushed in a direction. Now, I would argue that there's so little evidence of any of that, so we have they have some notion of an Eddington experiment that took place in 1919 or so, where, you know, they saw bending of the light by looking at a solar eclipse, looking near the sun, and the sun bent the light. They say, Einstein says anyway, as part of his theory of bent geodesic, that light is bent twice as much as anything else in the universe, which doesn't really make any sense. The preponderance of the evidence indicates that you can't bang a force into a force, that light won't be bent by magnetism, magnetism won't be bent by photons, and you can just go through all the lists, that all this little stuff never bends little stuff. The little stuff doesn't interact. It has to hit matter before you even know it exists. There is no action in the universe on any other level than the little bits of force hitting electrons and protons and telling them where to go. So the idea would be is that all the matter has nothing by itself. It can't move, it can't do anything. So an electron, a proton, has no capacity, no engine, no anything. And it's just basically being pushed by creating an environment of interacting forces, that is, forces that cause attraction versus forces that cause what we call repulsion. And those are just labels for an interaction, I would argue. And so gravity is the one, and so that's one that it's all branches out of. Relativity sort of branches out of this idea of space-time and whatever the bent geodesic would be, and that's sort of an, you know, most easily understood gravitationally. Then you have the kinetic energy theory, which also pulls out of gravity, and that was the first force being described, and therefore its properties ended up being properties of all the other forces, which was a big mistake. And then I don't know if there's anything else directly related to gravity in the sense that just gravity ends up being one of the obvious forces like photons, and then in the sense they're all moving the same speed. So that would be a sort of a giveaway that they're all made out of the same stuff, is that we found that the gravity and the light and the magnetism, it's all moving the same speed of light. So it would be more sensibly called the speed of force. But you know, science doesn't correct itself. It won't fix its mistakes. They labeled plus and minus wrong, and they never bothered to fix it, even though the wrongness means it does have implications. It's not a free mistake. All right, so I guess I still don't need to draw anything. All right, so gravity gets to an understanding that the energy in the universe can actually be consumed. So I've sort of made this simple argument that you can understand gravity just as thermodynamics, just as the fact is you sit here and the obvious effect is that something is moving you in a direction. It's pushing you down. And I would argue that the something is a real difference between the amount of stuff going up and the amount of stuff coming down. So that somehow the down is bigger than whatever's coming back out of the Earth, for example. So if you had an Earth, the idea is something more comes in, somehow it's diminished by the time it comes out this side. So the basic idea is stuff comes in from all directions and it leaves less than what it was when it went in. And the simple idea would be is it's less because to push matter, okay, so if we just said that's a bit of force, okay, so there's these little bits of force that are all the same in the universe, tons and tons of it, And all it's got a common property. It all moves the speed of light, and it never stops. But what it does is when it hits an electron, for example, is that it pushes it. It sticks to it. So unlike some sort of notion that the force bangs off of things like rocks, you know, you throw the rock and the rock comes back. Now the energy is completely goes into the idea of pushing the larger object. So larger object, by reasoning, you could understand, would likely go less than, all right, the speed of light. So while the force is pushing, the force is essentially going much slower than it would go. So it would be, say here, after a little bit of time, it's only going to be here because it's pushing the heavy piece of matter. So this is, in a sense, a consumption. Every time a piece of matter moves, an electron or proton, or the atoms that the electrons and protons are configured in, when anything moves, it's consuming some of the energy of the universe because it's degrading the progress of the force. So you can understand thermodynamically, the universe is defined essentially by how many little bits are going, how much distance over a period of time, and how much distance they're going is degraded by the fact that they're pushing little elemental bits of matter, and by pushing them, they have degraded their progress in the universe, how soon they get through the maze, so to speak. And that's what's happening inside the Earth. So there's a ton of little stuff moving inside of the Earth. That's why it's the fact that it's all these big objects are hot in the center. Okay, they're hot. And that's gravity working. That's the symptom of gravity, is heat. Because the movement is the cause. But the symptom of the cause is you're moving lots of little bits. Moving lots of little bits means you've got lots of stuff to bang into new stuff to cause, you know, interactions and cause other things to move. So everything's moving, and you're moving matter, and you're moving it less than the speed of light. So you have to think of every little tiny particle that we call matter that's moving inside the Earth, and every one of those things is stealing a little tiny bit of energy from the universe. It's using it up by degrading how far it's going to go in the universe. So essentially that explains why the Earth is essentially consuming energy by becoming hot. And it's not really a consumption, because you can sort of understand that that heat is also a form of radiation. It's also movement in the universe. But the net product is that, yes, it is less than what went in. What went in is a force going the speed of light. What comes out is a force going the speed of light. But there's just less of it because of the fact that it has spent time moving matter. And so it's a deficit in the energy coming out than the energy going in. And the symptom is heat. So all the big stuff in space is always going to be hot in the center, because there is a ton of stuff moving, being pushed, and all of that pushing adds to incredible pressure, because all the pushing is in one direction, the center. I mean, it's technically pushing, you know, that way, but it's that way that doesn't really exist in a sphere, okay, where the gravity is always going in, essentially. So it just that's why all the big things are hot, and is because it's a symptom of the fact that they're consuming a bunch of energy being pushed by all of this force converging into a smaller space. So you can sort of think of it as that all this matter is being pushed into the smaller space. And so it's the total energy of the universe, the pressure, that defines the size of the objects in space. Which gets to some cosmological stuff that's not terribly relevant. But anyway. So in a sense, that's a consumption of the energy, and that's why there's gravity. So gravity is just the idea that there's a rain of little particles in the universe, and what's happening when you're near another material body is that it's essentially consuming the energy of the little particles on the other side of the material body. So if you're here, all the little particles that end up hitting an electron or proton and pushing it for a little bit, that's a degrade in that energy. And so you're sitting here getting hit by this stuff that hasn't been degraded yet, and you're pushed in, and they're pushed in. And so from all directions, you're pushed in because there's more energy coming in than technically will be leaving. And you're part of that product. So every time you free fall, you're essentially consuming little bits, and you're, you know, consuming what would hit somebody else from their feet on the other side of the earth, technically. So you're creating the gravity that's causing gravity on the other side of the earth, because you're causing motion in this direction, which is consuming force that would balance against this force. This force has to balance this force, and any matter in between is going to ruin that capacity for there to be a balance. So there's more pressure on the outside, okay, and high pressure here, and simply just a low pressure here, because the pressure is being used up, consuming, the pressure is being consumed by moving matter. All right, and that simple understanding changes almost everything, in the sense that recognizing it's a real force, okay, just reflects to all the other subjects, and recognizing that the other things are just made out of the same stuff. It's just that you're going to change, you're going to create things like frequency, okay, and call that a photon. And then you're going to have a phenomenon of charge and magnetism, which are just recognizing that there's a little bit of a difference between some of the forces and the other forces. There's just two kinds of force, just like there's two kinds of matter, an electron and proton. There's proton force and electron force, and they behave inversely to each other in terms of pushing or being transparent. And that little difference creates all kinds of differences in terms of the capacity to make patterns and for them to see each other's patterns. Now, it's a little more complex subject, so I don't think I want to get there in this video. So I'll take a pause and clean this and try to get somewhere near my notes. Yeah, and such. Yeah, I guess I'll say a little bit more about gravity and understanding a fundamental difference in how it's viewed and how it's modeled or how it's understood or what kind of metaphors you can use. So I have used the metaphor of a bucket, all right, that matter is a bucket. And if you have a lot of matter, that is mass, you have a big bucket, you have a little bit of mass, then you have a small bucket. And the idea is you're in this rain, okay? And the rain is made out of the idea that, you know, there's more stuff coming from this direction, okay, from space. Space is hotter than the ground below you, which has obviously consumed heat. That's why it's hot. So appearing as your something looking hot means it's actually a space that has consumed energy to be hot. So you have to use heat to make heat. You have to consume the energy to have the byproduct of you being hot. But you being hot is essentially a symptom of you obviously have been cold. So matter could be thought of as a cold thing, but it's going to consume the heat of the little stuff moving at the speed of light and convert it into something moving slower than the speed of light. So it's a metaphor, the bucket, but it always stays connected to the idea that the little bit of force hits the matter and sticks to it to push it. And the idea would be as if it gets hit by more force, it goes faster and faster. So the more force it collects, the faster it moves. And the same general rule would apply to this analogy for gravity. So, you know, when you're in gravity, the rate at which you're collecting something that might be called momentum is not the same as the rate at which you fall. You'll fall the same rate because the amount of your percentage of matter that's being pushed is going to be the same. Big buckets collect a lot over a larger area. Little buckets collect less over less area. So the amount of push is the same, okay? But the fact is the big bucket is collecting actually more heat, more stuff, and that's why its momentum, when it hits the ground, will be much higher. Its impact know, big explosion, where this has little, you know, impact when it hits the ground, because when it hits the ground is when the force is going to be reconverted. That is, it's going to hit an opposing force, opposing matter, a high density of it, and it's going to essentially reject the motion, and by rejecting it's going to reflect it, and that's why there's going to be all this action, you know, when more matter hits the matter that's moving or been moved by collecting the force. And so this logically fits in the sense that you end up with an idea that if you want to double the velocity, you have to go 4 times higher. That would explain that obligation. In the sense that the gravity is being collected as a rate, and the faster you go, the faster you get out of the gravity. So it really just becomes a question. If you want to collect twice as much rain, you have to be in the rain twice as long. So your bucket has to be collecting twice as long, you know, your bucket is moving. So it's the rate at which it's collecting it. And it just matters in how long you're in the rain is how much rain you're going to collect. And the length of time changes. So to double the time you're in gravity, you have to go 4 times higher. And that's all it's really about. You're just saying, how do I spend more time in gravity? I have to fall a much longer distance because I'm moving faster and faster. So I start off with a small velocity and I move to a very high velocity. So I'm going through the gravity, the distance, much faster. And so that's what adds up to the fact that you gotta go 4 times higher to go twice as fast and to have collected twice as much momentum, twice as much energy bits, because it's really just about how long you're in the rain, not where you're moving, how you're moving. Now obviously if I stop it from moving, then the rain spilling out of the bucket essentially is being transferred into the ground, the capacity to move, the pressure, and so it's not collecting anymore. So it really is only the time you're moving in the gravity can you be collecting energy from the gravity. Right. So that's a key point. You know, if you have some other vision of how gravity's working, you know, then yeah, you're not going to get a ton of physics, because this is really just about how this motion argument, that you're really, all of the dynamics are going to be related to this fact that matter collects the energy and that it moves something less than the speed the energy was moving at, which means the energy has been degraded or retarded in its accomplishment in the universe until it's released. And so you can think of it trapping energy by moving, and also you can think of all kinds of other traps, but that's all there's really going to be, is there's just going to be transfers between very small force bits, okay, and small but real matter bits, electrons and protons, and then those clump, okay, and create atoms, and then there's going to be collisions between atoms and bigger collections of atoms, okay, compounds, bigger and bigger molecules, and then bigger and bigger things. And what you're really going to, what the thermodynamics is really going to be about in the end, is just about the rules that apply to when little thing hits big thing versus the rule for big thing hitting little thing. And the fact is the rules are different, which sort of blows a hole in any notion that that motion is relative. Because this sort of proves that it's not relative, it's sort of absolute, because it makes a difference whether it's a small thing hitting a big thing or a big thing hitting a small thing. Your outcome will be different. If the small thing hits the big thing, you're going to have stuff moving in both directions after the interaction. And if the big thing hits the small thing, you're going to have things moving, and both of them will be moving in the same direction. Very obvious different outcomes, and it really kind of demonstrates that there's an absoluteness to things' motion. You have a real absolute motion in the universe. Every little piece of you has forces acting on it at any one second. An electron is sitting in space, or an atom even, and there's forces acting on it in the sense that there's places where there's more energy or less energy because of all the interactions around things, and they're going to move based on any imbalance in those forces. So anytime the force becomes imbalanced, then the atom's going to move, or the electron's going to move, or the proton's going to move, or whatever you're pushing on in an imbalanced way. And everything in the universe has sought a balance. And that's why the atoms are balanced and everything seems balanced, because that's what it's going to end. The end game is that it's going to try to get quiet. And it's not really trying. It will inevitably become quiet. It's what it evolves into, is quiet places, and where things are more regular and sustainable. And that's, so everything's moving towards that direction, and it's just doing it in a very active universe where every time you find a quiet place, your neighbor starts making noise and, you know, ruins your fun. And so then you move and make a bunch of noise moving, and that causes somebody else irritation, and they move. And so because there's so much crap in the universe, is that it's very hard for it to stay quiet. All right, so try the next iteration. All right, back. All right, so I guess we'll get to the kinetic energy argument. So kinetic energy is basically fallout from what gravity's doing. So this idea that it takes you four times the distance to go twice as fast in gravity is a reason why they think there's some, like, that's more energy. More distance means, you know, somehow is proportional to how much energy you have, when the fact is that if you calculate the momentum, you're only getting twice as much time in the gravity, which means you only have twice as much collected in your bucket, because you only spent twice as much time. So even though you went four times the distance, you only spent twice as much time. So that little, you know, brain teaser led to an assumption, some bad assumptions, and so some idea that there's something other than just momentum. So my simple argument is there's the force bits all have their momentum. They're moving the speed of light and they have a mass. And then electrons and protons are some size bigger. Okay, they could be 10 times bigger, or they could be a million times bigger. Okay, and all you're doing is dividing the speed over the object. So you're just saying if one of these hits this, it's now got to spread its momentum, okay? So its one unit of momentum now has to be spread to 10 units. Let's say if it's a 10 times the size. So it has to spread its one unit over 10 objects, 10 units of mass, okay? And the obvious, the only way it can spread that is to degrade the velocity. So the object gets hit by one, it moves 1/10 the speed of light. Gets hit by two of them stick, well then it's 1/5 of this, 2/10 yeah, of the speed of light, which is 1/5, yeah. So it just keeps gaining that proportional increase in its speed based on how much this, how much it's collected in terms of energy, we'll call force energy, and it's got to spread over a larger mass. And that same principle applies to all the dynamics in the universe, that momentum, just recognizing you have a mass and you have a velocity, or you have a velocity and you have a mass. You have small things with big velocities and big things with small velocities, and it really is a real number, and the number just represents how much stuff moving the speed of light have you occupied in moving an object. And that's about all there ever will be to the story. And so you're just looking at relationships that take place and looking for the mass and the velocity. Now there, science says there's a thing called m, you know, 1/2 mv². And there's no evidence of it. There's no physical experiment that shows it. Simple devices like levers prove it can't possibly be true, because I can do the equivalency of putting a half mass over here and a one mass over here on a lever, and this one's twice as far, and it's going to move twice as fast as this object, and it will oscillate just fine, proving that this does equal that. That all I've done is taking more mass with less velocity and versus less mass with a higher velocity, and that adds up to the same amount of energy involved in the interaction. The same amount of bits of force are being applied to pieces of matter. So you could argue that the electrons in the half mass have 2 bits each of force, and the electrons in the big mass have only 1 bit of force. So there's more electrons here, but they're occupying less force, moving less distance, and that's the simple notion. So this was never well thought out. It was completely against Galileo, Descartes, and Newton. Then it was resurrected in the 1720s. I've given the whole history and some really poor clay experiments and experiments with sand. And as I sort of demonstrate, is you can make sand, you can make something look more energetic by going fast. It shoots things very far. It can give a lot of its energy to the first things it hits, because a fast thing, okay, has the ability to give an object that's of similar size a much quicker velocity. So it can, you get hit by a 5-ton train going 10 miles an hour, you're going to be moving 10 miles an hour when that train meets your flesh and pushes on it. The 10-ton train going 5 miles an hour, you're only going to be going 5 miles an hour. So clearly your mass will gain twice as much energy from the 5-ton train. But the idea is you're taking its energy. So the 5-ton train is going to give away a lot more energy with the first impact, where the 10-ton train can keep hitting people like you. It can hit twice as many before it runs out of energy, because it's giving each one less of its energy. And that's just such an important thing to understand, but it's not what science says. So anyway, these are very deceptive experiments. You could make something look like it has a lot of energy, but looking like and actually being more energy are two different things. So the object, you know, the point would be is that a small object going fast shoots a lot of stuff far, looks like a big bang. And a heavy object going slow will move a lot more matter, though, shorter distances. So when you add up how much matter was actually moved, it's going to be the same. It's the same amount of energy. It's just going to be transferred differently because of the difference in the velocity to mass ratio, but it's the same amount of capacity to move electrons. And that's just key. Again, this is a science says something that's just not true. And then they invented, like I said, they didn't invent the 1/2 mv² until the 1810 or so. And then they converted it into a new formula, even though they proved the old one. Now they had a new one that was substantially different. The half is a huge difference in the outcome. So it's just really bad science, and I think it should be argued that, you know, they shouldn't argue that this is proven when they don't have any evidence of it. They don't show you it taking 4 times more fuel to go twice as fast, and nor do they show you a tug of war between objects of inverse. They don't show 8-pound bowling balls going 16 miles an hour knocking over twice as many pins as 16-pound balls going 8 miles an hour. They don't show you any example of this in action. No physical, actual experimental evidence. And it's such a destruction to really understanding that this is all there really is. There's just motion, and the universe has it in two forms. The matter that doesn't move, doesn't do anything on its own, has no innate force. And the force, the little bits that never stop moving. And that's the key interaction. And that's why everything does something in the universe, is because the force only interacts with the matter, and the matter technically only interacts with the force, because the force is always between the different little bits of electron and proton, and basically keeps them from interacting except through the conduit of the force. So the force makes it possible for matter to see matter. We see other pieces of matter because it's basically reflecting force at us. We see it because we see the force, the change in the force it's creating. Its presence is saying, force is going to react with me. So it sits in the universe and it basically is a reflector of the universe. And so now we see it. Because we see the force, it reflects at us. We don't see it. We don't know of it. We know of it because it's sent us the messenger, which is the force. The force is obviously creating the message, but it's that's how you see it. That's how you know it exists. So the force is essentially the catalyst for the matter to even be able to interact at all. All right, so I guess we'll move on to the next bit of argument. All right, so a metaphor related to the subjects I'm heading for that I've used in understanding how the universe is functioning is much to do with this idea of an electron moving. And if you understand it's moving in a field of energy that's hitting all the time from all directions, you can understand that if I move my hand forward, all right, it's doing the inverse square law, by the way. So the inverse square law isn't some magical thing. Okay, I go half the distance, my hand is four times bigger. Okay, so it's exactly the same principle. Light bulbs are doing the inverse square law. So there's nothing magical about the inverse square law and gravity. It just has to do with things being spherical and shooting energy out in all directions. And this is what you're going to get when that happens, is this kind of reality, in the sense of how you're going to see perspective-wise as something's moving away from you. How the fact is that it becomes a smaller and smaller percentage of the universe you're seeing. You see, you know, in a cone, okay, and the percentage of the cone occupied by the object gets smaller and smaller. The object doesn't get any smaller. The force coming off the object doesn't get any smaller. Just the part you're seeing, because of the way you see things on the fringe, the angles. But the actual presence of something, an electron a billion light years away from another electron, they see each other just like they were next door. But the fact is the energy they'll be producing, they obviously can't feel each other's real force because it's going in all kinds of directions. But the force between them, the force that might move right between them, is always the same. You never change the force that's going straight towards something else. So anyway, but the idea would be is if I move my hand this way, you could understand that, you know, if you just understand as photons, that I'm going to increase the reflected light off my hand. As I push my hand forward, I'm moving into it, pushing more reflections towards you. And if I move my hand away, there's less reflections. And if I could theoretically move my hand the speed of light, there'd be no reflections, and my hand would cease to exist as far as you could tell, because nothing could reflect off of it, because nothing could catch up to it to hit it to reflect. And the opposite happens. If I could move my hand the speed of light towards you, nothing could reflect off of it and get to you any faster. But when it finally did get to you, it would collect every single photon in the distance it was moving, and you'd be hit with all of that energy at once. So understanding that that's the world electrons and protons exist in. So every time an electron moves, it shoots a bunch of force, so to speak, in one direction. And the direction it moved away from, you can understand it creates a vacuum, an absence. So this would be the phenomenon of how you would use electrons, okay, the motion of electrons, let's say, and protons, but electrons are the ones that are important for this part of the argument. Electron force, so to speak. So if I move this electron, the idea is when it went from here to here, okay, now it's changing. All the little force that was going here is going to reflect much sooner here. So you're going to reflect a lot more energy in this direction. And all the stuff going here that was going to hit here and reflect, now it's not going to reflect until here. So now this gets dark, and this gets bright. Okay, and you can just understand that dark and bright is on and off. You know, this is on and this is off. And you can just turn that into an understanding that what a photon is basically a pattern in space where you have more reflections Okay, this is where there's more reflections and more reflections because the electron was moving this way, and there's less reflections going that way. So in a sense, you're creating this part of the photon, you know, when you're going backwards this way, and you're creating this part when you're going forwards. So every time you jiggle something, you're creating a photon in that direction. Every time an electron goes this way and then goes back and then goes this way and goes back, it's creating an opposite photon in the two directions. So the photon in this direction, the photon going this way will look like that, and the photon going this way will look like this. The ons and offs will be inverse. So the matter can create photons. Every time an electron moves, it essentially creates two photons in the sense that it's creating one in this direction, completely out of phase with one in that direction. So this gets to a ton of entanglement experiments and other experiments where we're really just talking about phase of energy, the clumping of energy. And again, when I use this little clump, it just represents more reflection. So this could be made out of 10 little objects, or it could be made out of two. It doesn't really matter. You're just talking about a pattern being shot into the space. And when the pattern hits a surface, it has to hit the surface in such a way as to create electricity for us to say photon. So it's really about an electrical effect being caused in the atoms that make photons, that is the pattern you're creating with the electrons, visible as a photon. And that's all it is a pattern. So I could get into some details about how polarizers work and gratings and different ways that you can manipulate photons, but the key element is just this phase argument. Okay, so a blue photon, they're this close, red photon, they're this far apart. That just means that the electron moved further back and forth, or it moved little distance back and forth. So the frequency is just dictated by how much the electron is moving. And how much it moves, again, is partly, you can understand, is partly to do with how fast it moves. So how fast it moves means it can move more times back and forth. So if we were to say it was a set amount of distance, you could say that, well, slow movement would be red photon, fast movements would be a blue photon, the higher frequency. So, there's lots you can get into in this, but science says is that there's fields and there's all kinds of stuff and magnetic this and electrical that, and that these things don't have set paths in space, that they're not in an absolute space moving an absolute direction and an absolute velocity. And they've changed it into some sort of, you know, ghosts, objects that flutter in ways that have nothing to do with any mechanical cause. I don't think there's no need for that, is what I would argue. There's no evidence demanding you believe that. It can be understood as just a mechanical process. The electrons are in a sea of force, energy, little bits moving the speed of light. And when they move, the character of the universe changes. When they move, they compress those little bits, or they expand the distance between those little bits. And that explanation works. All right. Enough on photons. I think we'll try to connect that to relativity. All right. So Einstein's space-time and relativity. So the basic idea was simple, that he's just using, you know, kind of an empty statement saying, you know, that we're going to play a game to understand what gravity is. It's a gravity well. Okay, so there's some sort of centrifugal geodesic, okay, that essentially creates a well, that somehow if an electron is on this little line, he knows he has to bend down, 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 be curved into the, fall into the virtual well because of the force of gravity. Obviously a poor illustration. I mean, in two dimensions, it's using gravity to cause gravity, you know, explain gravity, which isn't very good, isn't very sensible. And so when they really teach it, what they're really doing is teaching a, what they call an anti-convergence, right? It's just kind of silly. I mean, an anti-divergence. So they're trying to say that it's the opposite of, you know, the sun, okay, without saying it's just the opposite of the sun, right? The sun is radiating in all directions, and obviously the further away you are, the less likely you are to get hit by these little particles, because they're spreading in two dimensions, which means the inverse square law. And so when they teach gravity, they just teach it as a convergence, frankly, okay, that essentially there's a bunch of water coming in. This is a drain, the water drains out the drain, and it's really even, in the sense it's like between two plates of glass. So all of the flow is very even. And so it's kind of an empty statement. It doesn't tell you anything about gravity or how it really works or the mechanics. There's no real energy in it. It's, you know, some sort of fake stream of some sort of new stuff. Now I would argue that even in Einstein's time, they knew that gravity and light and magnetism all moved at the same speed. So it really was the speed of force. And there's no reason to make any disconnection between the force that's causing gravity and the force that causes light and the force that causes magnetism. It's all the same stuff. It's just in a slightly different form. And, you know, that's the way it should have been perceived. So anyway, there was really nothing to go with this. It just looked good to people. This was easy to illustrate. Oh, falling into a well, that's easy to illustrate. It's easy to say it, but it doesn't say anything about a physical mechanical system. So what made this take off as an idea, even though it didn't say anything, it just says magically stuff falls in. There's no explanation for why it falls in, it just magically does it. All right, the geodesics says so. So it's not much of an explanation, frankly. All right, well, the key was is that in a little tiny gap in understanding the mechanics of the stuff orbiting in our solar system, there's a little tiny gap, all right, in just using momentum, you know, Newton's mechanics, Descartes' mechanics, Galileo's mechanics. And the the little tiny defect is in Mercury, something that's very close to the sun. And the fact is that its orbit is precessing. Okay, so it's making uneven circles as it goes around the sun. All right. And there's no overt explanation for that with the Newtonian mechanics, as long as the sun doesn't move. So as long as you understand the sun's in a solid one position relative to all these bodies, there's no explanation. But if you do recognize the sun, could its center of the sun's gravity could easily be moving. You know, the mass inside, the gas, the liquid, could easily have movement built into it. Very ancient movements built into it. Then you can understand that if the sun was moving a little bit, jiggling, that yes, the closest object to that jiggle will feel it. Just like an earthquake. Something close to the epicenter of the earthquake feels the earthquake, all the buildings fall down. Something further away like the Earth, it doesn't feel nothing, okay? So, you know, they have an earthquake in Indonesia, you're not going to feel it, right? Unless you're in Indonesia, because you're way too far away. So a simple explanation, the sun jitters, therefore Mercury jitters, therefore its orbit gets screwed up. No. Well, anyway, so Einstein was told, well, give me a mathematical equation that explains Mercury's orbit, and then we'll believe you. So he spent 6 months contriving his field equations, and in them, there was this idea. His first guess was is that light is bent by gravity by the same amount as regular matter. So an electron, based on its mass, would be bent a certain, you know, its velocity. So how fast you go through the gravity will decide how much you can get bent by it, and also how massive your mass is, obviously. So his first guess was that light would be bent as much as matter to explain Mercury. Now, I don't know exactly how the speed of light fits in, but I mean the bending of light. But regardless, he found that now he needed to have light bend twice as much. Okay, so he proposed in his math that fixed Mercury, that is the equations that explained Mercury's jitter, a 2x increase in the amount that light would be bent by gravity. Now, I'd argue they had no evidence that there would be any reason to believe light was bent by gravity, because light isn't, you can't bang light, you can't bang photons into photons and bend them. You can't bang them into magnetism. You can't bang them into anything going the speed of light and create any kind of interaction force won't interact with force. And so there's, at least it won't interact in a way you can see any difference. So then Eddington did the experiment in 1919, you know, with the eclipse and all that. It's a terrible experiment. He said, right in his own journal, I wouldn't stake my life on these results. He was hoping to get 10,000 stars on his photographic plates, and he got 1,000. That's how bad it was. 1/10 of the quality of the data. 1/10. So a very difficult experiment to do, even with, you know, good data. And he had clearly substantially what you would call poor data. It wasn't just that it was okay data. It was poor by his expectations. So he's doing something very difficult to do with good data. He got very poor data. And they wrote a New York Times headline, Einstein proven right. And there's all kinds of good reason to say he wasn't proven anything. All right, so they've never redone that classical experiment with comparable technology. And they haven't taken advantage of the fact that there's 400 times better seeing. All right, you'll see if you were looking for 1,000 stars, you see 400,000 stars on your photographic plates. That's how much better it is. 400,000 versus 1,000. 400,000. Huge advantage doing it from space, and you don't need an eclipse. And they've never done it. So I'd say, you know, science says, well, why doesn't science do first and then say? Do the experiment and then say. But don't do it the other way around. Don't say and never do. And so that was how Einstein got off the ground. And now we'll get to the velocity nonsense and the other crap, the other stuff they made into real evidence when it's not evidence of what they're saying it is. They're saying more, much more, than the evidence gives them a right to say. All right, so on the light bending thing, what science is supposed to do is build corroborating evidence. They're supposed to find evidence from fingerprints and then look for DNA and look for other kinds of evidence. You want to confirm your observation, your statement about the truth. So the light being bent twice as much by gravity thing is corroborated by some Hubble images, okay, where they say it's gravitational lensing. You know, the objects are not really where they look like they are. They're actually somewhere else, and we're seeing light in deflected ways. And none of those images follow any mathematical rigor. They're not consistent with a rational theory of gravity. They need to create things like dark matter, you know, fake matter, to create fake gravity to make them make any sense at all, because they're so non-spherical and non-rigorous. I mean, they're way off. You know, one side of the curve is this way and the other side is this way, and, you know, all kinds of defects that wouldn't be possible in any kind of normally understood optics. The lens is not a regular lens. Gravity is not a good lensing object. So anyway, so all of that evidence is mush, weak, as it's just what it should be described as. So the 2x thing doesn't mean much, but it's fundamental to giving Einstein credibility. That's all it should be understood as. So by arguing that light is bent by gravity, it confirms what Einstein needed to be true to make his relativity arguments regarding Mercury. But anyway, so the next part of the verification process was this idea that somehow velocity, part of Einstein's theory would be, is that velocity makes time, okay, change. And the simple argument could be made is any experiment you're going to do, you're just going to break clocks, okay, that somehow velocity doesn't change time, it just breaks your clock. That is, your clock doesn't tell time very good. So there's lots of ways to break clocks. I could take a sand dial into space and, you know, I can make it pretty irrelevant. If I get out of any strong gravitational influences, you know, the sand will just float around inside of it. Obviously you can break clocks. And so the idea is that their verification relies on two things. Satellites, you know, that have their clocks aren't correct. GPS, substantially. And it's all based on the same argument, that somehow velocity does in fact change time, that somehow time passes slower. And no, you just don't metabolize the same speed. So the simple argument is all they really are basing it on is atomic decay. So the idea of decaying atomic, you know, whatever the right way to draw it would be, you know, decaying atoms. So they say it's the decay rate of the atom is a true clock and you can't destroy it in any way. Well, we know that if I put radioactive elements next to each other, atoms that are radioactive, their decay, the likelihood of their decay increases substantially. So the closer I bring them to each other, I can take stuff that takes 10,000 years to decay and I can make it decay in 5 minutes. Obviously, a nuclear bomb is sort of taking advantage of that. You can increase the decay rate by forcing this stuff close together, and, you know, putting more atoms of it in the same space, in the same confinement, you'll increase the decay rate. So we know that decay is an environmental thing. It's caused by the environment. Something in the environment triggers the atom to break into two. And I would argue that I've used a simple analogy, kind of related to the Star Wars thing and killing the Death Star. You know, if energy was to go into an atom at exactly the same time, and you argue that the two pieces of force met in the nucleus at exactly the same time, that would cause an imbalance inside of the nucleus and cause the nucleus to break into two and create the little extra energy that is radioactive decay. And then all I have to do is move that atom. So if I want to change its decay rate, that is the odds of this happening, all I have to do is move it. If I move it parallel to that, you know, say this could happen from any position, any angle. Okay, so any of the spherical points, you would have this opposite, you know, Vulcan crashing into the Earth kind of thing. This event, well, all I have to do then is move that object, you know, where you need an event here and an event here. And once I move the object into the field, I'm reducing the probability of the event because I'm having more permutations this way and fewer permutations this way. So I'm not giving it the opportunity because I'm not rolling both dice. So let's say the odds are based on rolling two dice that have a million sides and it both coming up skull and crossbones or whatever. The fact is I'm rolling one die more than I'm rolling the other die, so I can never have the pair of skull and crossbones because half of my rolls don't count because both dice didn't hit the ground. So I'm changing the probability of decay by just creating velocity in a direction. I'm reducing the odds of the simultaneous event. And therefore, so that simple explanation does answer the question. It does answer how you break an atomic clock. It does answer the question, how do I cause the atomic decay of the substance to change? That's how I change it. That simple little mechanism changes it. So it could be some other mechanism. I'm just saying this is the one I thought of without much trouble. So this is just a story. You know, until they verify it with some kind of real evidence, there's an explanation that says you're just breaking clocks. You aren't changing anything called time. Time doesn't change in the universe. The universe has electrons and protons in it all over the place in certain positions. You don't change what time it is here or here or here or here. It's the same time everywhere in the universe. It's all stuck in the same place. And it's all moving in real distances in that place. The speed of light is so constant. It's so reliable that we can see light that's billions of light years ago moving across space. How could it be different times? It's not different times. It's the same time. It's moved from a very long time ago, and it's moved through space. And it's, you know, if it had eyeballs, it'd be watching the Earth. It could watch it do its whole thing on its very, very long trip. And time didn't change anywhere in the universe. It's all the same time. And if you move something, you can physically break it. And it would be logical for you to understand just how easy that would be. If I moved you very, very fast, you'd have to understand that every single one of your atoms, every bit inside of you would have to move that very fast speed. If I start moving all of your bits in one direction, then don't you really become the very thing that was pushing you? If you start moving as fast as the stuff pushing you, then your stuff is basically just turned into that force. You're basically just being converted. If I can move you the speed of light, I've basically converted all of your elements into photons. I've converted you into the force. There can't be any matter. So that's why matter will never move the speed of light, it's because it can't. But anyway, because it can't be something it's not. It can't be a force. If 10 things, right, if I have 10 bits of matter pushing an electron, 10 bits of force, it's still 20 bits of force, in the sense that the matter still has to be thought of as 20 dead bits. And so no matter what this force does, it always has to be diluted to move the dead bits. Live bits can't move dead bits for free. They have to lose some of their velocity to move the dead bits. So if you just thought of an electron as being, 20 little dead force bits, okay, then you'd understand why the matter can never go faster or as fast as the speed of light, because no matter how many I put over here, no matter how many bazillion I put behind it pushing it, it still has to push those 20 dead ones, and that's going to take a little tiny bit off of its speed. So anyway, so the time dilation argument, I don't think there's anything else I have to include in there. Let me just make sure I didn't miss something. So it's just breaking clocks is the simple answer. GPS can be understood as, the fact is there's two ways that you can look at what you're in. And the idea is being in more force is what's causing the decay change, is being in an irregular amount of field energy, right? More stuff on one side than on the other side breaks the permutation odds. So obviously on Earth, right, when you're sitting on the Earth, we already know there's a gravitational potential where there's less stuff coming out than is coming in. So you're in that. So if I put an atomic isotope here, it's already in an imbalance. It's already getting hit by more rolls of one die than rolls of the other dice. So it's already decayed. And the fact is that's what they're really adjusting. The thing out in space is actually the normal decay rate because it's further away from the Earth. It's in less gravity. So even though it's going much faster, it's going 20,000 miles an hour, the fact is the thing close to the Earth is affected by a lot more of a force differential than the thing out there in space going very fast, because this is a denser field affecting it. So they're not even... people have the wrong notion that they have to adjust the clock out there when it's really the clock here on Earth that's in more trouble in terms of not being what it would be in free space. That is the quietest place you could put it in the universe. That's the real decay rate, is when you have one atom without anything interrupting it. So it has a perfect balance from all directions. That's the real decay rate. And we're the one that are in the worst condition versus the satellite's condition. So people don't even understand that that's the real game, is just how much force you're in. So there's two ways to look at it. Gravity's causing part of this relativity. Okay, that was general theory of relativity. And the special theory just has to do with the idea that velocity is an element. Well, you don't need the velocity. You just need to be in force inequity. And so that's why the force inequity of gravity is greater than the velocity increase in the emptier space. Okay. So that's probably enough of relativity. But all of these things they say are, the old way that they used to, in a polite way, say to each other, you're wrong. They would say your theory is incomplete. Okay, well, their theory is profoundly incomplete. Their model doesn't model anything that can be tested. So anytime they say we've proven it, they've proven it with circular testing, where the test is based on the theory. If the theory wasn't true, the testing doesn't work. So they're testing with a theory, really, that's you know, it's all circular. It's self-dependent, self-generating confirmation. They don't tell you anything real. So they don't show you 4 times gas to go twice as fast. You know, they don't show you a place where time is different. You know, they won't show you any real evidence for any of these assertions about what they say, you know, quarks and nuons and gluons and puons and all of this stuff, the 400 made up little elements. They don't have a place for them to live. There's no place for the neutrinos in any kind of rational model of the function of an atom. It doesn't work. There's no place for this stuff. It doesn't have, you know, they haven't shown any hard evidence that any of it has any reality, and there are simpler explanations. And so I'm not going to bother in this video going into charge and magnetism, but that gives you a huge clue into how you create a bunch of subtle nuance in how the universe functions. And all the subtle nuance is just in the idea of controlling whether you're pushing something, you know, with a force, or whether the force is merely converting, you know, changing its direction, or changing its properties in some other way. So it just gets as simple as the idea of how do you create attraction. Well, you create attraction by moving this way and creating a vacuum behind. Vacuums create attraction because the universe is pressurized. It's full of energy. If there's some place where I make less energy moving, then I've created a vacuum. I've created a place where you're likely to get pushed into. And so there's no attraction. There's just repulsion. There's just a push. It's a push universe. Everything's getting pushed around, and that's it. The force pushes, the matter gets pushed, and if there's an absence of push, that is, once you push something this way, you create a void of push behind it. And that's all you can do, is create absences, places where there's less pushing going on. All right, but there's no pull, there's no elemental pull, there's no notion of what an elemental pull would even look like. So those basic facts should be stated as a context. It should always be known as the context of a conversation is understanding that, yes, pull is inconceivable. There's no pull mechanism. Pull requires you to latch onto something and create mechanisms that can pull, where push is so elemental and obvious, and it's obvious in what's happening in the universe. It's obvious every time an asteroid hits the Earth. It's about push. It's not about pull. All right, anyway. All right, so we'll call that a video. Yeah, I'd like there to be interaction and response. So if you can take anything, any quote, anything I said in here and say that's wrong, I'd love to hear it, that you've proven it wrong, or that you have some real evidence to show demonstrating it wrong, that, you know, I'll be willing to address any sincere critiques. Be best if you actually watched a few of my other videos just so you knew the details of all the arguments, but regardless, I don't think you can do it. I don't think you can find any evidence, okay, in the volumes of physics that could be demonstrated to be without reasonable doubt. I think it's all subject to quite reasonable doubt that your interpretation of the evidence is the right interpretation. And I would argue that this simple model fits it all, fits the experimental evidence, creates more than enough of a satisfactory explanation for any phenomenon you can show. All right, so we'll call it a video and such. So this has been draftphysics.com, debate physics also. I'd love to hear a debate. I'd love to hear somebody actually make an argument in a video form. But nobody's really capable of that, so far, so bad. It just can't happen, I guess. With the current audience, there's no willingness to engage in reasoned conversational debate, unfortunately. So, till the next time and such.